The Guardian.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. On the show this week...
It's definitely for me a marathon. We will be doing this, I think, for this entire century. The most complicated machine that we know about is ourselves.
We'll be hearing from the British computational biologist, Dr. Ewan Burney, about the ENCODE project, which has released its latest results and is mapping the vast territory of the human genome. And...
I think another possible policy implication is, in a sense, the good news that smaller family size is leading to fewer descendants, which I think from a global perspective is a good thing.
Professor Anna Goodman discusses her latest paper, which puts a question mark over the assumed evolutionary benefits of big families. Also, I'll be joined by Observer science editor Robin McKee to discuss the great Stephen Hawking's latest outing onto the small screen with his TV series Grand Design. And with just as much ambition, we'll be hearing from Geraint Jones on this year's British Science Festival in Aberdeen. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. One of this century's great landmarks in the biological sciences was the public release in 2003 of the map of the human genome. But this initial outline of our DNA found only 2% was the genes that code for our protein building blocks. In the intervening years, a consortium of international scientists working on a project called ENCODE have made great gains in mapping the so-called desert regions of the genome. Recently, ENCODE released a raft of 30 papers on their research and made public their growing encyclopedia on the human gene pool. Alok Jha met with one of the scientists on the project, British scientist Dr. Ewan Burney, to discuss the expanding frontiers of genomic science.
So in 2000, we published the draft human genome. 2003, we published the finished human genome. And we always knew that was just going to be a starting point, a kind of foundation. And in fact, there were some pretty high-level meetings at that time to ask ourselves, what do we do next? And what's the next set of things that you want to do? So one line, which is not the work here, is about variation, how we're different between people, and then how those differences are associated with disease. The other line was just, how does the genome work? We knew that the genome had protein-coding genes in them, but we knew that was the minority. In fact, a very small amount of the DNA was involved in protein coding genes.
Something like 2%.
1.2% is protein coding exons, and maybe closer to 2% is all the exons involved in protein coding genes. So the next question is, how does a genome work? How is it? This is a recipe book for one of us, for a human being, and what is the recipes beyond the protein coding genes?
And so this was an attempt to try and understand what the other 98% was doing. Now, Typically, and this is wrong now, but it's been called junk DNA because we didn't know what it did and no discernible function was attached to it. Tell us why you would want to study junk DNA, first of all, and then why that name is maybe a misnomer.
So... we always knew that protein coding genes were not the whole story. So in particular, we know that protein coding genes get switched on and off in different cell types. So your liver cell has lots of enzymes involved with metabolizing maybe bad compounds and also alcohol and all sorts of different things. Whereas your hair cells makes keratin. Now, the hair cell knows that it should make keratin and not these liver enzymes. The liver cell knows that it should make the liver enzymes, not the hair. That control must have been somewhere in the genome, and we always knew for some individual genes that it was indeed in elements sometimes quite far away from a gene. But we didn't really have a genome-wide view of this, so where all the elements were. So we set about trying to work out how we could discover those elements. And certainly one of the big surprises is we see way more elements, way, way, way more elements than I was expecting walking into the project, and more than many other scientists did.
And so these control elements are all in that, let's call it, non-coding DNA element. Now, to give me a helicopter view of the ENCODE results as published now, how much of the genome, how much of this non-coding DNA are you starting to understand, and kind of give me a context of how significant that is that we've now started to understand these things?
So at one level, we've looked at every, we've looked across the entire genome. And at one level, we look at every time there's something very specific going on in a place in the genome. And when you sum all of that up, it's 80% of the genome. Now, that's a pretty big number, way above 2%. But it shouldn't actually be a number to surprise you, because this is looking at all the times when a gene is on or off. And although the protein coding exons are very small, genes are quite big. There's large bits that are cut out. So this is, in some sense, that 80% is the total amount that is either switched on or off in a particular cell line. Now, what is just as important, in fact, for me, much more interesting, are the switches, or the places that we think are controlling which bits are on and off. And our best estimate of what we've discovered, about 6% of the genome, when you add that up with exons, it's a total of 9% of the genome, is involved in either exons or these very specific switches, where a specific protein is binding a specific piece of DNA sequence. Now, ENCODE was genome-wide. It is a very, it's a larger scale project of this sort, but did not survey every type of protein that can bind DNA, and it didn't survey every cell type that's in our body. But we've got some estimate of what we expect the saturation curve to look like as we add in more and more experiments. And so that 9% we believe to be, it's definitely not everything in this category, and we think that may go up to 18% or 20% looking at the way these things saturate. So that's, for me, is a surprising number, that 20% of our genome could well be involved in specific regulation. And that's surprisingly big for most scientists.
So just stepping back from that slightly, so the 1% to 2% that codes for proteins, these are the things that you're familiar with. They're the genes that code for every protein in your body, that does every single function, all your muscles, hormones, all those sorts of things. And then the extra 6% that you're finding now, these are things that turn those protein coding genes on, off, maybe upregulate, downregulate. Yeah. And how important are they to how healthy someone is, or how well these protein coding things are working?
So this was the other beautiful moment in ENCODE, because we compared the ENCODE results to these disease studies that have also been looking genome-wide. And in these disease studies, they take a disease, sometimes heart disease, so whether you have a heart attack or not, or a type of cancer or Crohn's disease, and they look at healthy people, people who don't have the disease, and people who do have the disease, and say, is there any little bit of genome that's associated with changing the risk of this? Now, the surprising thing in those disease studies is about between 50% to 75% of the elements that they find are not close to protein coding genes. They're away from protein coding genes. And these have always been a bit difficult for people to deal with, because we know very little, or we did know very little. Now, when we bring that together with ENCODE, there is a surprising overlap between the ENCODE information, where switches are that switch things on and off, and where these disease risk places are. And that's been a beautiful thing. Actually, when it was first, when we first saw that result, I thought it was a bit too good to be true. I had to be persuaded myself. We've done the analysis about 5 different ways now. And it still definitely holds up.
Can you give me some examples of those, and what kinds of regulation causes what kinds of disease, for example?
Just to give you some perspective here, it's always easy to talk about the examples where it agrees with how we understand how the disease works. There are other examples which I'm less comfortable about talking about, because I'm not confident. All manner of weird and wonderful artifacts occur in the system.
Well, given that we're at the beginning of this sort of research, then go for the ones you're confident about.
It's okay. So one of our little poster childs is Crohn's disease. This is a very, it's an awful disease of the gut, an autoimmune disease. That's when your body turns on yourself. And we've always known that it was involved in somehow in the immune system. And indeed, when we look at the ENCODE, the risk, the places which change risk for this disease across the genome do overlap very heavily with T helper cells. Now, T helper cells are part of the immune system, And everybody sort of expected this. Now, what was less expected was that the Crohn's disease elements also overlapped with a transcription factor called GATA2. Actually, GATA2 is a member of a family that we call the GATA family, and there's quite a lot of reasons why we think it's the family of transcription factors, not GATA2 in particular. But that wasn't something expected by Crohn's disease biologists. So we confirm one thing that the Crohn's disease people know about, and then we also say to them, well, maybe you should have a look over here at this transcription factor. How is that this transcription factor is influencing the risk for disease?
Just explain what a transcription factor is for me.
Sure. A transcription factor is a protein sequence which binds a specific piece of DNA. And one important way to think about this is that we are trying to understand how the genome works. It's like a very complicated book in Russian, and we don't know any Russian, and we're trying to teach ourselves Russian. But we do know of a machine that understands DNA, and that machine is ourselves themselves. So we have a machine that understands it. We can look at that machine, and by looking at that machine, we work out where specific proteins bind to DNA. We call those specific proteins transcription factors.
A lot of this stuff, as you say, as soon as you start to sequence it and understand it, it just produces another set of DNA, RNA, whatever, to actually start to understand. I mean, it seems like some Alice in Wonderland sort of situation.
Yeah. So I do appreciate this from the outside that people might say, well, wait a second, didn't we sequence the genome in 2000? Didn't we do this? And that was the starting line. That was the start, not the finish line of this thing. And it's definitely for me a marathon. I remember I was involved in the early analysis of the human genome, and I absolutely remember this feeling that we will be doing this, I think, for this entire century, which is trying to understand how humans work. And like I said, we are one of the most complicated, if not the most complicated machine that we know about is ourselves. And the idea that this was going to be a simple thing to understand is slightly hubris. I find it now difficult. I mean, it's bad enough wrapping your head around C. elegans, which is a small worm with only 600 cells and stuff like that. That's hard enough. A human is just awesome in its complexity. And somehow that complexity is encoded in the genome, which is really a remarkable project.
Now, can I ask a few more general questions about sort of where then genetics research like yours is going? You're building these enormous catalogs, and then people are going to go and search through them, find meaning, annotate them, and continuously for a long time to come. Every year, we newspapers are full of stories about personal genomics.
Yeah.
This idea that you can get your genome sequenced, it's dead cheap, give it to your doctor and they will store it, and they'll be able to provide you with genome specific drugs in 10 years. They'll provide you with ideas of what kinds of mental degradation might happen to you. Who knows? Of course, the problem with all this is that it's very hard to tell you specifically what's going to happen to you, even if you know the genetic information. If we have to start storing this other stuff as well about people, you know, all these transcription factors and all this, it increases the amount of information. Do you think it actually increases? I mean, if someone wants to get their genome sequenced, that's great. But does it increase the amount of knowledge we have about that person's future?
So I think we are still feeling our way forwards here, but I'm someone who I'm very positive about the direction. So I think we already are at the stage where we use genetics and genomics in these very specific cases, and some point in the next 5 or 10 years, it will become more obvious that we should just have it as a routine part of healthcare, but it's not going to change healthcare in a very deep way. I think of it a bit like X-rays. So X-rays, imagine the world. There was a world before X-rays. You didn't know what was going on inside of people's bodies. And when X-rays were invented, in fact, there's an incredibly interesting history of medicine about the discovery of X-rays and how they've been exploited. So suddenly people could see inside of people's bodies. It really changed some aspects of medicine, but not all aspects of medicine. And critically, it's not sort of completely definitive. Sometimes it's really useful. Do you have a broken bone or not? Answer yes, no. Yeah. But other times it's really just helping the doctor work out precisely what is wrong or how to go the next step. I think the genome will be used in a very similar manner to X-rays in the future. I wouldn't surprise me if there won't be a kind of medical specialty about genomic medicine or whatever we end up calling, just as there is about radiology. So doctors whose job it is to stay on the cutting edge of genomic research in the context of practicing healthcare. And I'm working with a number of doctors who I think the same way, and that's really exciting. Now, doing medicine, genomic medicine, it's going to be a long task because we have to study enough of it in the right circumstances to really affect medicine. And there's lots of bets being placed effectively by different researchers about what's going to be the most effective route. Will it be about rare genetic diseases, which we might be able to find across the entire population? I quite like that approach and as one thing. But maybe it's far more about cancer genomics. A lot of people think that cancer is going to be our very first early win because cancer seems to be a very genomic disease and you can tailor drugs not necessarily to you, but really to your cancer that you get and say this is the right set of drugs for that cancer. But maybe just as important is infectious biology. So the fact that we'll be able to find out what's infecting you when you get a hospital-acquired infection. But before you even do that, I think we will be sequencing the floors of hospitals regularly and understanding what is the bacteria, like an immune system for every hospital, to know what are the potential outbreaks that could be happening in that area. And so before it even happens, we can monitor it. Now, there's probably five or six other things that I don't know about that are perfectly feasible ways of using genomics and genomics technologies in healthcare. And at a first approximation, we should be exploring all of them. And then one can get into a bit of a bun fight about which ones deserve more money than others. And that's a bun fight for scientists and clinicians to have between us.
So, I mean, this idea of junk DNA, which we started with, we can categorically say that junk DNA probably doesn't exist. So where does it leave that idea that there's large tracts of genome that don't do anything?
I mean, I just think that's it's quite a pervasive metaphor. Junk DNA and the idea that there's the important stuff and lots of stuff that's not sort of being used. I just don't think it's a very useful way of thinking about the genome. I just want to expunge it from textbooks. I just think it's not helpful. That's not to say that all of the genome is definitely doing something useful. Like I said, there are these genomic parasites, these repeats that copy themselves. Clearly not all of them are useful because we've turned them over in our history. But I want to reset the kind of null hypothesis towards most of the genome or good whack of genome is doing something.
A huge thanks to Dr. Ewan Burney there. And to read Alok Jha's feature on the state of genomic research, just head over to guardian.co.uk/science. Also, if you want to delve further into the science of genomics, the full hour-long interview is available on our feed as a Science Weekly extra. Now, with not a strand of junk DNA in sight, I'm joined by the Observer Science editor, Robin McKee, and down the line from Aberdeen is Geraint Jones at the British Science Festival. Welcome to you both. Geraint, let's come to you first of all. You've been up in Aberdeen for the British Science Festival this year. What's caught your eye this week? What's been interesting that's been reported up there?
Well, there's been loads on, but just to summarise three things that did catch my eye particularly. One was quite a dystopian view of the future, which is quite worrying. So Professor Paul Fowler from Aberdeen and colleagues have been working on the effects of endocrine disruptors on the fertility of animals and human beings as well. So they've been monitoring a flock of sheep which are grazing on pasture which is fertilized using sewage, basically. So chemicals that we use in day-to-day life, from cleaning fluids all the way through to the contraceptive pill and everything that ends up in our sewerage, ends up being used as fertilizer. And it appears that these chemicals are making their way into the food chain and affecting these sheep. And the levels that they're measuring are almost imperceptibly small, but they do seem to be having observable effects compared to a control flock of sheep that they have where this fertilizer isn't used. So they were just raising the what they see as a serious matter that we should really be looking into this. And if these effects continue to grow with fertility decreasing, etc., then it could be a future problem.
So what kinds of things are they concerned about?
Well, they made the point that in the lab, lots of these chemicals have been tested using high doses for very short periods, whereas they've been conducting this research for several years now with very, very low levels. And they found abnormalities in the testes of fetuses and also the ovaries of fetal animals as well. Fewer eggs were being produced, and just generally signs that these would probably result in premature menopause and lower fertility.
And there is presumably a concern that because this stuff gets into sort of waterways and things like that, that there is a problem also for humans as well.
Yeah, they were saying that it's being transmitted to humans. It's just in the air. It's not just a matter of us consuming meat from these animals. It's probably making its way directly to us as well through just contaminants that we're in contact with day to day.
Okay, so dystopia aside, what else has cropped up at Aberdeen?
Well, it was a really fascinating project ongoing led by the British Antarctic Survey. So there's a subglacial lake, Lake Ellsworth, which is buried under a thick layer of ice, and it's probably been buried for several hundred thousands of years. They're not quite sure when exactly it was covered. So under the ice, there's a lake which exists because of geothermal heating of the bottom of the ice sheet. And this has probably been isolated for such a long time. They're really interested in seeing if any life is down there, and if it is, how has it adapted to the conditions? There's going to be no sunlight, and they want to measure things such as the carbon content of the water. If they can't find life itself, at least the requirements for life down there. So it's a really big project. The equipment is on its way out to Antarctica at the moment. So they'll be drilling in the next few months, and they hope to be bringing samples up from the lake in early to mid-December. So they'll have a very short time to get the samples up. They're boring down through the ice using a high-pressure hot water system, which has been completely decontaminated. They don't want to take anything down there which they'll contaminate any samples they return. And once they break through the ice, they'll be able to take samples of the water, and also they'll get down to the floor of the lake and return samples of sediment as well.
Great. How big is this lake?
Well, it's about 10 kilometres long, and it's thought to be tens of metres in depth, and it's over 3 kilometres of ice.
Blimey.
So it's quite a major project to get down there.
Anything else from Aberdeen, or is that the best stuff?
Well, I may be biased because it's close to my research area, but there was a talk on solar storms earlier this week. So CMEs, these are coronal mass ejections, big expulsions of material from the sun. If they hit the Earth, the magnetosphere, this magnetic cage surrounding the Earth, they can cause big effects down on a ground level in extreme cases. In 1859, for example, the biggest event in recent times hit the Earth, and people operating telegraph, Morse code operators on telegraph systems were electrocuted, and there were currents set up in telegraph systems which allowed them to send messages without any electricity. It was just powering itself. And we've been fortunate not to be hit by anything quite that big since then, but the possibility of a severe solar storm striking the Earth has been added to the UK's national risk register. So it's now something that is being looked at quite closely. So they've taken data from a big event in 2003 and scaled it up to see what effect that would have on the national grid system in the UK. So as one of these CMEs would hit the magnetosphere, it sets up currents high in the atmosphere, in the ionosphere, and these drive currents down on the surface, which get carried along power lines. So this could really affect transformers, which represents millions of pounds of investment for the electricity companies. It could result in power cuts, for example, and it might take quite a while to recover from that. And they found that, somewhat surprisingly, in the UK, because the currents flow east to west rather than north to south, the longest stretch of power cables is in south of England from Cornwall to East Anglia. And in 2003, they did have some failures of transformers at either end of that system. So that doesn't seem to be the area that would be struck most badly if we were to encounter one of these storms, which is bound to happen one day, but when exactly we don't know.
What kind of notice would we get for that? When we get a CME going off on the sun, we do get notice from the satellites that are in an orbit close to the sun.
Yeah, so the typical ones, we'd get 2 or 3 days notice, but really big ones where their speeds could be over 2,000 kilometres a second, the warning could be as short as a day or so. The National Grid do take notice already of space weather conditions, so they are aware of it. But it just brings home how serious the effects could be as we're becoming more and more reliant on continuous electricity supplies and communication networks, how seriously it could affect us if we do get one of these big storms soon.
Wonderful. Geraint, thanks very much for that. Great just to get a report on what's all been going on up in Aberdeen. We'll see you soon. Bye for now.
Bye.
Robin, you've been down at a very prestigious event at the Royal Society last week. What were you doing down there?
Well, I was drinking champagne, actually. But you say it was prestigious. Sorry, there's a new TV series, Grand Design, which features the ruminations of Stephen Hawking coming out on Discovery Channel. And they're having a grand launch there, showed a 15-minute segment of the programme. They had Benedict Cumberbatch, who actually does a lot of the voiceovers for the show, and who, of course, once played Stephen Hawking in a BBC drama. He was there. We had Dara Brien leading a panel of experts discussing of science and physics. Will Self, Martin Rees, and other distinguished members of the panel. It was illuminating and good fun stuff.
So did anything good come up in the debate at all? Or?
Well, there was a sort of interesting... yes, it went all over the place, actually. I particularly liked that they had a debate on God. Could it be compatible anymore, God and science? And it's interesting, actually, in fact, the scientists are less dogmatic about it than the public are. Discovery Channel's actually done some research that suggests scientists do see some role for is it completely incompatible belief in God and belief in scientific method, and many scientists than members of the public think that it is possible to have an overlap. So the scientists there were not too dogmatic about the thing. I rather liked Will Self. He was talking about the inverse of Pascal's wager. Pascal's wager is, of course, on your deathbed, you may as well believe in God because you're not going to lose anything and, you know, you'll get to heaven in the last minute.
I'm rather inclined to the inverse of Pascal's wager, which you recall. Well, of course, you were brought up on it, but some people here may not be familiar with it, which is that it's best to observe conventional religious practices and forms of theism, because if at the moment you die, you discover that God does exist, you'll be very glad that you did. I tend to the inversion of that. I tend to the inversion of Pascal's wager, which is if you spend all your time going to hear the very estimable Rowan Williams preach his sermons, and he's a very, very lovely man, though I'm not so sure that he's that big on God himself, judging from the and all those very boring sermons and all of those tombolas, and you put a fiver in each of them and you go along and jolly good, and then you die and you discover that God doesn't exist. Just at the moment of extinction, you will feel like a complete fool and that you've wasted an awful lot of your life. So I do tend to that side of the argument.
It's possibly the most coherent argument or interpretation of argument I've heard from Will Self as well, because I listened to a lot of the debate and I had no idea what he was talking about.
He was, yes, and apparently in the green room beforehand, he was up for a religious fight, and, which Dara Brien and Martin Rees just weren't for having, really. You know. But he was out there for a punch-up over God, which I like that.
The main theme of the debate was where science goes in the next sort of 40 to 50 years, and it sounds as if Martin Rees brought up a really interesting idea about the where do we go, where science goes and where particle physics goes and so on, and then looking at the post-human era.
So there's a long way to go before we have anywhere near the so-called theory of everything, which is a theory when we can unify gravity with these other forces. But I want to put in a cautionary note and say that even if we have this theory of everything, then it won't be the end of science. It'll be the end of a quest that started with Newton, went on through Einstein, etc. But it'll be irrelevant to 99% of scientists. Because what challenges most scientists is not the very big nor the very small, but the very complicated, especially living things. And the analogy, if I give another analogy from a game, if you are watching chess being played, you've never seen it being played before, then you can probably infer what the rules are. But inferring the rules of chess is just a small step before the absorbing progression from being a novice to being a grandmaster. So even if you've got the rules, even if you've got this theory of everything, so-called, then the real challenge is to understand how those rules apply in the very complicated world that we are part of. And I think if we ask about what's going to be exciting in the next 40 years, it's going to be exploring those complex consequences and understanding, in particular, the origin of life. And I think that's going to be helped not only by molecular biology, but also by one of the most exciting developments I expect in astronomy in the next 10 or 20 years, which is studying planets around other stars. We know that other stars are orbited by retinues of planets, just as the Sun is orbited by the familiar planets, including the Earth. We've learnt this just in the last decade, essentially. Within 10 or 20 years, we'll be able to image planets like the Earth orbiting other stars. And that'll be a really exciting subject to see if there's evidence for life on those. And so the origin of life and also the places where it exists, whether aliens exist, is going to be crucial. And my final point is that there may be some questions which our brains will never understand. Just as chimpanzees couldn't understand quantum theory, there may be some deep aspects of reality, even the final theory, that are just beyond human brains and will have to await the post-human era.
Robin, who was that interrupting Martin Rees there?
That's Stephen Hawking, who was right at the front and made several interjections on his remarks like, I told you so, and things like this all the way through it. So that's him making his presence known.
He's getting cheeky in his old age.
Yeah, apparently after the reception was over, he demanded to be taken to a pub, and so he went with Benedict Cumberbatch, and the pair of them ended up in the pub. So there you were, you had Stephen Hawking and the man who played him in the TV film sitting there swilling pints. What the people in the boozer thought, I don't know.
Turns out they went to the Mint Bar, Robin,
and they were drinking cocktails. And
I'm only sorry I don't move in the circles where I could have been with them.
I had to go back home early to be up into the office, you see.
Get your Horlicks.
Okay.
Robin, as ever, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks to Geraint Jones and Robin McKee there. And remember to read the best science and technology news on a Sunday. Just pick up a copy of The Observer. Thanks also to Discovery Channel. Stephen Hawking's Grand Design starts Thursday, the 13th of September at 9 o'clock. One of the topics discussed at the Royal Society talk dedicated to Stephen Hawking was the need for scientists to resist absolute specialisms, to move out of their individual silos, to collaborate and cross-fertilise research fields. And that's exactly what Anna Goodman has been doing in her role as social epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Alok Jha met with Anna to discuss her latest research into the relationship between economic and biological success, as well as her work around a very London concern, London's public bike scheme, known affectionately as the Boris Bike.
So Anna, welcome to the podcast. You're a social epidemiologist. Tell me what one of those is.
So to me, what that means is someone who's interested in epidemiology, which is study of health and disease in populations, and in particular in relation to social factors. That might be things like ethnicity or rural or urban status or the built environment or how deprived your area. So these quite big social things, as opposed to maybe smaller things like, literally smaller things like germs, for example. Have you been exposed to a certain sort of virus?
And so you can use massive data sets to glean patterns and insights that maybe are invisible to people looking individually.
Yes, exactly. So whereas doctors are trying to look at an individual patient and say, what's wrong with them? How can I make them better? Epidemiologists try and look at a population and say, what are the most common sorts of illnesses? What predicts that, and how can we intervene to make the population as a whole more healthy?
Well, let's jump into some examples of where you've used this technique then. And you looked at the relationship between public health and sustainability drives in cities. To take us through your work on, I don't know, for example, cycling.
Yes, so this is one of my big interests, is the intersection between public health and environmental sustainability. I think they're both key issues for the 21st century, and they have a lot of overlap and a lot of ways in which they complement each other. So one example is walking and cycling. If we can encourage people to use cars less and walk and cycle more, that's good for their health, it's good for the city in terms of less pollution, it's also good for the climate in terms of less greenhouse gas emissions. So a lot of my projects are based around looking at types of interventions to promote walking and cycling. One recent one's been the London Cycle Hire Scheme. So trying to look at who's using it, how well it's used, what types of people are using it and how that's changing over time, and maybe what the health impacts are likely to be on London as a whole.
So just to explain to people who don't live in London, the Cycle Hire Scheme is simply racks of bikes all over the capital where you go in and you hire a bike out for a couple of hours and then put it back into some other rack somewhere else.
Exactly.
So, and the idea is to get more people cycling because we want more people to be healthy and all of that. So what are the insights you've gained looking at the usage stats on that?
So the research is ongoing in collaboration with Transport for London, but in the first few months it's been very well used. It's popular. A lot of people are using it. There's slightly less encouraging findings with regard to gender and socioeconomic equity. So in London as a whole, we know that women cycle less than men. That's true in a lot of places where cycling's rare. Cycling's fairly gender equal in places like Amsterdam where it's common, but in places where it's rare, there's more men who do it. And we'd hoped maybe the Cycle Hire Scheme would be a bit more gender equal. It might seem more accessible, more an everyday sort of thing. But actually, so far, it's even more male-dominated than cycling in London as a whole. So whereas a third of cycle trips in London as a whole are estimated to be made by women, it's about 18% of the cycle hire bikes.
And that's a surprise because I mean, this was meant to be much more simple, just to jump on a bike and off you go. You don't need all the paraphernalia and the Lycra.
Yes, well, that was my hypothesis coming into it. I mean, it may still in the long run. I think if it establishes cycling as a more normal thing to do, which I think it may, and we're doing more research, look at it, it may become more gender equal. But so far, that hasn't been the case.
Well, why? Do you know why? I mean, do you have any hypotheses around why? It's difficult just with data to work this out, and you're not asking them individual people questions. But any ideas why it should be so gender equal?
This is... No, I think this is something I'm very interested in. I only have kind of wild ideas, not well-informed ideas. I mean, it may be something about the demographic. There's a lot of people, kind of commuting business people using them, which, again, is a more male-dominated demographic. So what I like about this sort of research is it's what's sometimes called a mystery story. You start with something observed but unexplained, and then you try and find reasons for it.
And as is the way with science, you usually get more questions rather than fewer.
Well, indeed.
Yeah. But that keeps everything going. What else, I mean, have you been working on in terms of the public health and sustainability? I mean, these sorts of things are, I imagine, useful for policymakers as well when it comes to designing schemes or encouraging different people to sort of take part or whatever else.
Yes, so there's been a number of studies. I've been collaborating with colleagues at the Centre for Diet and Activity Research in Cambridge who were part of consortia evaluating some quite large interventions, for example, building lots of cycle lanes in an area or the Cambridge guided busway. So the results are, we haven't finished those studies yet, but that will be quite important in terms of informing these sorts of interventions.
And what can you do with the results? I mean, beyond the sort of scientific sort of curiosity of value and the mystery angle, how does it help councils, politicians, whoever else, designers, to actually improve the urban landscape, to achieve some of the goals that they want, but maybe don't know how to get to?
Well, I think often they have there's a lot of good ideas for how to do this, but what's often lacking is robust evidence about effects. And there's something in epidemiology that's talked about as the inverse evidence law, where we know least about the sorts of interventions that are most likely to have a big effect on the population. So, for example, there's quite a lot known about individual-level interventions. It's easy to do an individual randomised trial And for example, there have been done randomised trials of giving individual advice about encouraging people to walk. And there's quite good evidence that those can work. However, to scale those up to a population level, one could do that, but it might be much more efficient to try and design an environment that encourages everyone to walk and cycle. So the scope seems massive, but there's much less evidence about whether that works. So I think by providing an evidence base that can both provide people with the evidence they need to advocate for these things and also ways to improve them so that we can learn as we go.
Now, have there been any notable successes with this approach? Are there ways where social epidemiologists that you know of or have used techniques like this to evaluate something and then that thing's been improved and has done the required the result that whoever the council member or whoever wanted or has increased the health of a population or has made more out of cycling or whatever else more gender equal? I mean, are there examples of this, or is this a field that's still early stages?
I think in relation to walking, cycling, the built environment, it's fairly early stages. I think it's only come on the policy agenda in a big way in the last decade or so. So I think that's probably still ongoing.
Let's move on to something else. You're not only interested in epidemiology, it seems like your latest paper is all about evolution. And it's about let's call it the conflict between the socioeconomic and biological success of a person. Tell us a bit about this.
So this is, this is something fairly different. This is a sort of second string to my bow. I'm interested in evolutionary things following on from my background as a human scientist, which I did study as an undergraduate and is a very interdisciplinary subject. And together with colleagues, my colleague Ilona Kupel at the Centre for Health Equity Studies, Stockholm University, Karolinska, and David Lawson at University College London, we've been using a fantastic data set from Sweden to look at this question of the demographic transition. This is the phenomenon whereby people, as societies get richer and modernised, they start having fewer children, which from an evolutionary point of view looks crazy. And we were testing different theories about why this might be and trying to unpick the extent to which socioeconomic success and biological success might be complementary to each other or in conflict.
And so what was the data set you used? How did you sort of start to try and answer that question?
So the data set we used is the Uppsala Multigenerational Birth Cohort Study. This is a birth cohort of all the babies born in Uppsala Hospital between 1915 and 1929. Uppsala is a university town in Sweden. It's a bit like Cambridge's in the UK. And there were 14,000 babies born at that hospital in that 15-year period. And using the fantastic Swedish record linkage system, we were able to link that to data, so census data, health data, other sorts of data for them and all their descendants
up to 2009. Doing epidemiology in a sense, handling big data sets. This is not unfamiliar territory to you.
This is one of the things. I think that epidemiologists usually study health problems and evolutionary biologists study evolution problems, but a lot of the sorts of data that we want to use are the same. And so part of the reason why I put this collaboration together was seeing that this was a health data set, but had fantastic potential to answer these evolutionary questions.
So what did you find?
So the two theories we were testing, the competing theories, were one of them, both of them agreed that it looks crazy for people to have four small family sizes if they want to maximise their evolutionary success. The first theory said that perhaps in the long run it is adaptive. People have smaller family sizes, but their children do much better in terms of wealth and status and survival, and therefore they'll go on to have more children, and in the long run you end up with more grandchildren, more great-grandchildren. The other theory agreed that maybe it's good for the socioeconomic success of offspring, and the reason why people try and maximise that might reflect evolved psychological preferences in parents, but said they didn't think it would translate into any biological success. And to cut a long story short, the second hypothesis is what was supported. The smaller family size did predict children having better school marks, having being more likely to go to university, having higher income. This was true also after you adjusted for their social class, and it also was true not just of children but grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So in socioeconomics terms, there was a large payoff to small family size, but that wasn't translated into having more offspring. Having smaller family size was associated with fewer grandchildren, fewer great-grandchildren.
So but from an evolutionary point of view, though, does that equate to some sort of success? How would you define that? Because, I mean, from an evolutionary point of view, really, the more children, the better, surely.
Well, exactly. So if the ultimate metric is reproductive success, then having a small family size didn't translate into higher reproductive success. You had a smaller number of grandchildren. So I think what we talk about is this being a sort of mismatch between ancient evolved psychological preferences and a modern environment. In the past, having high-status children often did translate into higher numbers of children. Evidence from historical or hunter-gatherer traditional societies suggests in the past that would be true. But for various reasons, in modern societies, that links break down. For example, child survival is so high that there's not much difference between poor and richer groups in terms of the number of children that survive. So in modern societies, that link breaks down between socioeconomic success and biological success.
So are there any policy implications for this? Are ways that, you know, governments need to think about how, you know, things are rewarded or structured, societies and public health systems and things are structured because of something like this?
I think that this was motivated by a sort of research question. So it's primary, it wasn't done in order to have policy implications, unlike my walking and cycling research. I think, though, there are some which kind of stem indirectly from it. One is the social equity point that family size was associated with socioeconomic differences across multiple generations, which I think, particularly the fact that that's seen even in a fairly socially mobile country like Sweden, points to the need to seek to equalise opportunities across children, including with respect to family size. And also, although this wasn't the focus of research, there were large differences with respect to socioeconomic position as well. So the parents, richer parents, had children who did much better, and their children did, and their great-grandchildren did. So I think there's some social equity messages there, that even in Sweden more needs to be done. I think another possible policy implication is, in a sense, the good news that smaller family size is leading to fewer descendants, which I think from a global perspective is a good thing. I think humans are going to have a better chance of surviving long-term on this planet if we do have a stabilising population. And then maybe as a final implication for researchers, this is, I think, very good news for any of the researchers who are trying to study current human evolution. Often people do this by using current total family size as a proxy for long-term success, because you can't wait multiple generations to get long-term success. You say, well, we'll try and use total family size as a proxy. If it were the case that having a small family size actually ended up having much more descendants, it would mean that you couldn't use your family size as a proxy. That wouldn't be a valid measure of your long-term success.
You need more generational data.
You need more generational data. As it is, the fact that family size predicted very closely longer-term number of descendants means that this does seem a good proxy. So methodologically, that's very helpful for researchers studying human evolution in general in current populations.
Anna Goodman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A big thanks to Anna Goodman there. If you want to follow up on Anna's research, you'll track her down at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine website. That's lshtm.ac.uk. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. Thanks for listening, and do join us next Monday. From me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.